I think in the case of something like this, you're in the presence of something like contextualism in the full sense of the word. And I don't think it is private or strictly hermetic. I think that both iconically and spatially, the building speaks for itself. Iconically, it relates to a long, protracted Wittelsbach administration of Bavaria. And spatially, in the whole of its aggregation, I suppose, it responds to and animates the pattern of an older Munich of about 1840, of which it comprised approximately one quarter. Then, I think at the same time, it might be abstracted from both of these contexts and be seen as an independent statement, as a quite vital configuration in its own right, and surely comparable with, I think we have one over here, with something, again, like the Hofburg in Vienna, which is also one of my favorites. Now, could we have the next two, both sides? Okay, so one could make a confrontation of two other megastructures. I think Peter Cook's Plug-in City over on the left of 62 or thereabouts, and Hadrian's Villa at Tivoli over on the right. And what could one say about them? That in both cases, and in different ways maybe, spatial context is problematic. That Hadrian's Villa is scarcely located on a site which offers overt spatial clues. That Plug-in City is so far located on a blank sheet of paper. Maybe that the message of Hadrian's Villa is largely eclectic and retrospective, and that the iconic content of Plug-in City is largely anticipatory. One would think those were among the obvious distinctions. But I suppose it might further be suggested that Hadrian, over on this side, by endorsing and also playing with the established and the familiar, places himself in some kind of context of cultural continuity. And this then allows him to violate that continuity while retaining the meaning of the various images which he chooses to recall. That by operating within the density of traditional agglomeration of ideas, he creates a species of context which simultaneously is both retrospective and prophetic, perhaps. I think those are hypothetical questions, but with regard to Plug-in City on that side, they scarcely arise. And the suggestion is made then of a more versatile temporal and spatial contextualism in this job on this side over here. And this can be carried over, I think, into areas of spatial concern, because the assembled patterns of Tivoli over here do allow for the coexistence of both spaces and object buildings. And at the same time, I think Plug-in City is quite happy with a one-way exhibition of prime solids and largely residual voids. I think we try another one over here now, please. So we return again with Plug-in City again to the Hofburg. And like Plug-in City and like Hadrian's Villa, it is a conglomerate of an exceptionally agitated outline. But unlike these, it's an outline which is directly predicated by specific relationships to physical surroundings. It's the most brilliant, I think, play with adjacencies, and it involves all kinds of provocation of further levels of order. And in this way, I think one could say it acts as a highly complex instrument of both accommodation and proclamation. Well, that's so much for one kind of argument, but we didn't have, I think, too much about megastructures or contextualism on the whole. And I don't think we heard anything of the garden as criticism of the city. The garden as criticism of the city, I think, is an important topic. Obviously, Versailles is a criticism of 17th century Paris. If you can't make it with buildings, you make it with trees. One thinks of the early years of this century, when there existed really a very important tradition, I suppose, of formal gardening, which might be demonstrated by a pair like these. A German housing layout in Baden-Baden over on the left, of not too much earlier than the Hildesheimer thing that we were looking at. and Platt's plans for the McCormick House in Lake Forest over on the right here. Now, all this idea of a structured entourage to a building was obviously destroyed by the so-called modern movement. And one can understand why. I couldn't find a Rietveld house. Somebody else must have had them, but I thought a Rietveld chair would do just as well as a Rietveld house. So here is a Rietveld chair of 1919, and over on the other side is another house by Charles Platt. Larchins' gardens would have been better, but they seem to have disappeared, called Girdle Ridge, Catona, New York, 1912. So 7 years separates these two pieces. And clearly what you get over on the right-hand side here is a quite obsessive and frenetic analysis of the object, in which only the solid is interesting. And of course, when you promote that as building, then all these adjacencies, garden adjacencies like these, which extend and elaborate and do the setting for building, naturally go away. They simply cannot survive. I just bring up the topic of garden as criticism of the city because I would suspect that the first phase of the reintegration of the city will be some kind of re-establishment of the landscape garden, for which I have a few slides. It's not the landscape garden, the regularly constructed garden, like the Wallenstein Palais in Prague on the left, as the type of thing that it's awful hard for us to do nowadays because all that got thrown away, or the Hôtel des Marais in Paris, 18th century from Blondel, over here on the left, with the most elaborately, exquisitely structured garden related to it. And also, since I think I'm going on rather a long time, no, not altogether, one would look at things like these, I think, and see them as potentially carrying messages for urbanism, like Stowe in England on this side, or Chantilly over on the left. Particularly, I think, something like, could we have the one on this side, something like Chantilly, which offers this incredible balance between structured areas of Cartesian order, interspersed with all kinds of delicate and lyrical little passages of randomness. It offers you the best of all worlds, as far as I can see. And we have another one over here, just the usual tourist view of Chantilly, again, looking that way. Well, that again concludes another little topic. I would have loved to have heard somebody talking about the garden-city relationship. I think as the critique of the city of modern architecture proceeds and the revaluation of that sort of city on the left, myself am increasingly disposed to look at examples of German cities. I always have been, for that matter. And here we have a couple of German cities. I think on the whole that my taste runs to Italian architecture and German urbanism, as a matter of fact. But we're looking here at a plan of Castle in, I think, 1803 or 1804. And I'm always intrigued by the way in which a medieval development like this then gradually expands and regularizes itself into areas of this kind. And over on the left, we are looking at a series of plans of Hanover, of as it was in 1816, and with further plans down below, I think, of 1816-17. And this is the documentation of Hanover, I think, is a perfectly exemplary one, and a little austere, so I hope you will have patience in continuing to look at it. Could we have the next over here, please? It is quite clear to begin with that what was being begun here in Hanover in 1816 is a pendant to what was being begun in London in Regent Street in the same year. After all, the Prince Regent, the future George IV, was not only Prince Regent of England, but also of Hanover. And the if this little job begins here with a Waterloo Place, etc. So I think a Waterloo Place with a Leibniz monument or something got placed over on that side. I think the two problems are different because obviously the Regent Street job is a linear sequence, whereas what we're going to see in Hanover is the development much more of a field sort of situation. Could we have the next over here, please? Apparently a primary issue which Laves was faced with was the build-up of areas relating to the city palace, the Leinerschloss over here, which he is playing with in all these places. It has no, scarcely any setting there. It begins to acquire a monumental setting in here, and there are all kinds of different proposals for its setting as we go through plan after plan. This was one of the pieces, obviously, that was important in the evolution of what was to go on. And could we have the next one over here? And the other was also the great gardens and country palace of Herrenhausen outside the town, which we can locate, I think, somewhere over there. This is where the Electra Sophia sat year in and year out, waiting for Queen Anne to croak so that she could become Queen of England. Unhappily, Queen Anne sent her an unpleasant letter just about 6 weeks before Queen Anne herself died, and this caused Sophia to have a heart attack, so it never came about. But I'm sure she would never have had such a nice house as this in England when she got there anyway. So that, you know, perhaps it wasn't all that disappointing in the end. Could we have the next over here, please? This is to look at the sequence of studies of Laves as they proceed. In 1818, he's throwing out a road in the direction of Herrenhausen. In 1820, he's beginning to build up a big field on the edge of the fortifications over there. In 21 to 22, the structure of that field is somewhat beginning to change. This round point becomes bigger. And in 25 to 26, it has changed again. If, as seems likely, Laves was having to report all this in some way or other to George IV in London, one can perfectly well understand, since he was so wayward, fluctuation of different projects which is occurring here. But it is an exemplary documentation to look at. As you can see, the situation developing still further. In, I think on this side, 1830, 1841, another one in 1841, and another one in 1842. What has happened by 18, well, what has already happened in 1841 is the railroad tracks have come into this area, or about to be planned. In 1841, they make them do a different thing, and in 1842, they make them do still a different thing, and a fairly big triangular sort of plats has begun to form up in this area. Sometimes it tends to get an opera house in it, but of course the railroad tracks, again, are the opera house crept in it on this side, in these later studies over here, which are of apparently 1843 and 1850 to 60. Well, I just show that documentation because it's fascinated me a great deal recently, and it is so astonishingly thorough, and the way in which Laves went on for years and years and years, something like 40 years, struggling with the different problems, I am sure is the mode of attack that should ideally be adopted. We tried to do something like it the other day, playing around with a funny little project for Rome in which we were given this particular site with the Celio and the Palatine and the Aventine as it was in about 1750, and what can one try to do with it. And we are not as clever as Laves, so that we didn't, and we didn't also have 40 years to do it like he did. So we came up with something anyway, which is, could we have the next one over here, is present on this side. I think we're looking from somewhere over here And unfortunately, I think an airplane is about to crash into the middle of the Colosseum or something of that kind. Now, okay, the big question is, of course, what has all this got to do with you-know-whom? You know, what's it got to do with us? Yeah. Okay, so, again, while I was struggling trying to find slides, I came across this 19th century view of the capital, which amused me very much indeed, because obviously it combines the comic, the tragic, and the satiric scenes all in one. Indisputably, the dome of the capital is the supportive piece and belongs to the tragic scene. All this park that lies between it and the foreground incident obviously relates to the satiric scene, and the foreground incident is obviously comic in lots and lots and lots of ways. Similarly, I think this plan of Wiesbaden over here on the right offers you an area in which you can discern the activity of the comic scene around here. The tragic scene is obviously operative in these areas. And out in this villa suburb over here, I take it you do have the satiric scene. Now, I am going to sound, we could have the next one over here, please. I am going to sound a little bit 4th of July, because I am concerned with a pair of opposing American statements. One is that business about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the other is that statement about this is a government of laws, not men. Now, naturally, neither of those statements is true. But whether they are true or false is of no matter whatsoever. Because if a sufficient number of people accept them as propositions, then they become established and active in the way that established propositions do become. The proposition about government of laws, not men, obviously, by certain standards, is quite absurd and quite ludicrous, because obviously laws are made by men, period. But of course, if you assume that they are not, if you assume that there is a natural law which is either given by God or inherent in nature, then you can operate perfectly well with that presumption. Again, I would suppose that people were not put on earth for any purpose whatsoever, let alone life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The fact you're put on earth for the pursuit of life is itself a redundancy, I think, regrettable on Jefferson's part. But anyway, what I want to do is to see those two statements as, again, structure and event. And I am assuming, again, that this is structure and this is event. But I'm also assuming that the two may be interchangeable, again, like the components of a figure ground drawing. I'm also suggesting that if people abandon fantasies of total design and holistic planning, if they do that, and if they merely accept the kind of adversary condition which is presumably written into the democratic process, then a great many things which are apparently so difficult at the present day really might become comparatively easy. We're accepting this then as structure, although it might be event, and this as event, although it might be structure, and we will just run through a sequence of events on this side very quickly. Next one, we can have that, and next one, we can have something like this, which is a piece out of Berlin of, I think, the early 60s, and awfully sweet, I think. And could we have the next? We could have something like this, all related, I think, to that. And the next, we could have something like this, if we wanted. We're getting fully into the heart of the romantic suburb now, England in 1803. We could have the next. We could again, have, if you like, have something like this. And the next, we can have something like this nice women's jail from Würzburg of 1809. I'm told that in actual fact it's rather miniature and not at all the great big Piranesian extravaganza that it appears to be. And the next, we could also have a little more Las Vegas, although I'm getting tired of it. And the next, we could even have a little lyrical mini-utopia of this kind, the Prado della Valle at Padua, the elliptical canal describing the elliptical island and the four bridges across it as an elegant, it has obviously relations to the thing on the left, though, that one. And could we have the next? We could have more of this stuff. And the next, we could have this kind of thing. And the next, we could have more of that stuff. Again, Berlin of the early 60s. And the next, I think, and again, a bit more Munich of the 1840s, the Munich of Ludwig I and Leo von Klenze. I wanted to really do this with the sequence of Munich, but I couldn't because the slides were not there. And could we have the next over here? And we could have little pieces like these, which is obviously a study for the most interesting of little towns, with some acropolis up on top of a hill there, and some kind of harbor situation down by the water, and a medieval nucleus, and a kind of thing, and then the gridded tragic scene. And I think this must be a dock adjacent. I'm not really quite sure. And the next, okay, and ending up with something like that. Okay, well, what I could only say, I think, is that I suppose the triumphal entry into the Holy Jerusalem is the whole world's wish. And always as we, who are the saints, or think of ourselves as the saints, come marching in, we enter not to accept, but rather to insist. Titus enters the historical Jerusalem to destroy in order to create the regular Roman world. And no less destructive, I suppose, was also the entry of Christ. For in neither case was there any idea of accommodating the city as it was found. The Roman emperor wreaked his vengeance on the city, and the Christian God-man who came to fulfill was equally concerned with urban renewal, I think. He wasn't a bit pleased with the city as he found it. He only wished to enter it as a theater related to the events of his own death, which is one of the reasons why cities are so important. They do serve as theaters for important events. Where else could, for instance, J.C. have found the appropriate audience? He could only die in the city. Galilee was surely altogether too provincial and hole-in-the-corner place to, perform any great action. For an appropriate demonstration, the city is required, etc., etc., etc. And so you get that kind of entry, a little bit like modern architecture, with, it's a parody of the triumphal entry. It's both humble and grand, coming into the city and condemning it and requiring it at the same time. Because otherwise the whole act is thrown away without the city, and you might just as well be in any old little suburb, or alternatively in Galilee or Bethany or Cougar Heights or wherever they lived, with Martha and Mary having little dinners with Martha and Mary. Martha being such a good cook and Mary being so intellectual, so you get the best of both worlds. But okay, I don't think that the idea is to enter the city either as a saint or as a redeemer. But then what do I think is the appropriate way to enter the city? I've tried to intimate, but I can't in any lecture a talk of this kind. I think that the way to enter the city really is from the point of view of a museum curator who is not trying to be fashionable, who retains memories of the Holy Jerusalem, but also knows that that city is never to be built, and who, recognizing the priority of the tragic scene, is also trying to build up a good representative collection of the tragic, the satiric, and the comic, all three. I will now, after this little interval is over, be overjoyed to hear what Matthias thinks about these things too. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.